Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today is an expert in home orchard management, sustainable landscape practices, and integrated pest management. Pamela Geisel Plemons received BS and MS degrees from Chico State University, Fresno, in agriculture, with emphasis in pest management and environmental horticulture. She moved to the UC Davis campus to become the program director for the statewide Master Gardener program. Today I'm going to ask her about a book she co-authored, The Home Orchard, Growing Your Own Deciduous Fruit and Nut Trees. It's a book for small-scale growers. Pamela Plemons, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. I'm happy to be here.
You know, I appreciate some of the things you have in your book, like a glossary. That's very helpful, those of us who don't know a lot about this subject. And also, your photographs and illustrations are essential. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I studied them because I thought, oh, yeah, there's no way you could explain that in words, but there's that illustration and the photograph. Now, there are also a lot of authors.
Yes. And I want to say that this is the second edition. So I was one of the primary authors on the first edition. And then the second edition has a lot more to it because things change. And we covered a broader area of California to include more Southern California growing conditions. All of the authors on the first edition were from the Central Valleys of California, and so we tend to be rather focused to that environment. So this is really great if you're in some of those marginal climates, coastal climates, as well as introductions of new rootstock varieties and things like that.
And I noticed that you are a technical editor, and Chuck Ingalls, his name comes up often. So you were a co-editor.
Yes.
Of this edition.
Yes.
The second edition.
Yes.
Well, I asked friends, if you could talk to somebody who was an expert in this subject, what questions would you have for them? So one friend, for example, said, well, I wonder how much sun do I need? Because her whole backyard is a garden. And so I thought, well, I'm sure you know about that. And then the next friend I asked, I said, if you could talk to an expert, what would you ask this expert? And she says, oh, I wouldn't have to do that because my husband is a master gardener.
Oh.
And I never knew that about her. I thought, oh, that's fun because that's your what you do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, what is that? That you're director of the statewide Master Gardener program?
So I'm retired now. I just want to be clear.
But, yes.
And so there's a new director. But I was the first and was the director of that program for quite a long time. And the Master Gardener program is a wonderful program throughout California. Most counties do have that program, and it's a volunteer program. So, for example, in Butte County, they have a Master Gardener program that's associated with the University of California. Their goal is to take all of the research-based information that the university produces, which is a lot, and extend it to the public, to their clients. And people who need information are the best people to teach because they want to know because they have their own problems. So specifically to the home orchard, you know, if you could ask an expert, a UC expert like a master gardener, you know, we're extending that research-based information. So that's the whole goal of that program. So
I'll remind listeners, my guest is Pamela Geisel Plemons. And the title of this book that she co-authored, The Home Orchard, Growing Your Own Deciduous Fruit and Nut Trees. So I was interested in the fact that John Bidwell, our founding father here, found out you could grow just about anything here.
Yes.
Is that true?
It is pretty much true. You know, there are some limitations, but because our climate zone is such, it has kind of the best of everything. So a couple of things that you need to have a home orchard is chilling hours. And those are hours of temperatures below 45 through the winter. And that helps to facilitate the bloom of our fruit trees. And if we don't get those chilling hours, they don't bloom properly. They have overlapping bloom, or it just doesn't bloom at the right time, or the pollinators bloom at a different time. It just messes things up. So that's why, you know, specifically like to the coast where they don't get enough chilling hours, they have to plant typically low chill varieties. But we, in our climate zone, which is a Central Valley climate zone, hot in the summer, cool in the winter, perfect Mediterranean climate, we can pretty much grow anything. And in fact, one of my goals in my own garden is to have fruit every month of the year. So that would include citrus. Now, our home orchard book does not include citrus, but we have other books based on citrus, you know, that are out there. But so I have fruit from starting in probably April through of my deciduous fruits through October. And then my citrus come in. And so it's really fun to have fruit every month of the year.
Well, one thing that I've discovered about myself, each page I turned in your book, I thought, gosh, I am so ignorant. I didn't know the extent of my ignorance until I was looking at your book. Oh, my gosh. And so,
well, I think one of the reasons, I mean, there's a ton of information online, of course, about a home orchard and how to manage a home orchard. But there is so much you can know. And having a book as a reference that you can just pull down when you need that information, you don't need it all the time, right? But
yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, it's really a wonderful way to kind of keep up. And then you can read it at your leisure to learn.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is a large book that I thought, yeah, this is the kind of book you want on your shelf because the questions come up and you wouldn't say start page one and go to the last page because you would look up and say, oh, so that's how I should do that.
So
when I should do it.
Yeah. For example, one question that a lot of people have is, you know, do I need a pollinator plant?
Oh, yeah. I wondered that, too.
So you want to plant a cherry tree. What cherry trees can I plant that will also pollinate, so they'll pollinate each other? Well, that's stuff you don't keep in your brain. Well, at least I can't keep it in my brain. So you could look it up and go, okay, I'm going to the nursery, and I need these two varieties of cherries. So then you have to plant two cherries. Well, I don't have room for two cherries. How could I do that? Right? You could plant two trees in the same hole, and you would have your pollinator and your – and they'll both produce fruit, right? So there are certain nurseries that will graft multiple varieties onto the same tree. So I don't love doing that because if one of the grafts – we'll say dies, you know, you kind of lose that variety. And plants don't grow at the same rate. Any different varieties don't grow at the same rate. And so one can take over the other. But anyway, you know, so there are options for planting those multiple varieties.
One thing I've found about the couple of fruit trees that I have is every year's different, just about.
Yeah.
And I don't think I do anything different, but they seem to have a mind of their own.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, some of the things that I hear about and people ask me about is that. Why am I not getting fruit? Why are all my fruits falling off? How come they're so small? And there's a couple of reasons for that. You know, improper pruning too hard or not pruning enough, overcropping. So if you don't thin the fruits at the proper time, you know, when they're about an 3/4 to an inch in size, generally, depends on the variety, of course, but proper thinning so you don't overcrop the tree. If you do overcrop it, and that's when you get those branches that break, and, you know, the tree goes, oh my gosh, what's happening? And they'll not bear the following year, and you get into an alternate bearing cycle, and it's really hard to get it back to, you know, a consistent even cropping. And that's your goal, really, is to try and have that even, consistent cropping from year to year.
Well, I often wonder, because I often do the pruning when it occurs to me.
Yeah.
Like, oh, that limb's in the way. I can't get by, so I'll just cut it off. And then I wonder, oh, is this the right time to be doing this?
Mm-hmm.
So you've just explained something that I didn't realize that, so that makes sense.
Well, the good news about pruning, and this is really an interesting thought about how to grow fruit trees in a small garden, and that is summer pruning. So when we talk about how to prune trees, most people think, well, dormant pruning. And that's good to do, absolutely. But we find that if you prune a lot in the summer and cut off excessive growth and keep the trees a little smaller, we call them fruit bushes, that you can produce a great crop. And summer pruning slows them down so that they don't get so big. And also, one thing that's really important, especially this year, is to prune out all the suckers that are growing up into the center of the tree, because they block air movement and you end up with a lot of disease problems. For example, in my own orchard, it's really a nightmare this year. I didn't get a single apricot because of all of the late rain we've had. And the brown rot just came in and took out all the fruit, which is a fungus disease. And I could have sprayed for it if I were more timely. That's the other thing that's so important, is doing things at the time they need to be done.
That's what I always wonder, if I'm doing that. Now, my very talented producer, Matt Fidler, who's recording.
I love him.
And I do too. And he's listening, but he is a gardener. And I said, Matt, if you have any questions you want to ask Pam, feel free to ask. And so I noticed that he was nodding when you were talking just now. Matt's nodding. So, Matt, what question do you have for Pam?
Well, you know, I have a ton.
But, I love it.
You're bringing, well, one of the things that you brought up, Nancy, we were talking about how your crops are different every year.
Yeah.
And I know this book isn't specifically about citrus, because you just said that. But I do have a question about citrus, and certainly I have a variety of amount of, I have a grapefruit tree, and I have a couple of orange trees, and I have a lemon tree, but I've noticed my grapefruits and oranges some years just taste really lousy. They're really bitter.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if there's something wrong with my soil, if I'm not watering correctly. I don't know. What kind of things should I test? Because my oranges are sour, but they haven't always been sour. So I know the variety. I think they're Matsumis, and those are one of my favorite citrus to eat. But mine aren't tasting good. What should
now,
I test?
Are they Satsuma mandarins, or you said
yes,
oranges?
Yes, Satsuma mandarins. Yeah,
mandarins. And so, you know, a lot of that has to do with the weather during the ripening period, because. And also when you harvest, if you, if they're not getting full sun, they're not getting enough carbohydrates to produce sugars to make them sweet, that could be part of it. But a lot of it is due to the weather during the developmental period, you know. And if you're not getting enough heat units, the warmth that they need, they may, you know, not develop as much sugar. Also, it somewhat depends on when you harvest. If you're harvesting too soon, they're going to be bitter. They're not going to be very sweet. Low fertility can influence taste. High fertility can influence taste. If you're pushing it with too much, even organic nitrogen fertilizer, you're going to push a lot of foliar growth, but it's not going to develop good quality fruit.
So maybe my PK is, you know, the potassium and phosphorus is maybe a little bit low, because I'm in Chico, so I'm getting plenty of heat.
Mm-hmm.
It's getting plenty of sun.
Okay. It could be.
Yeah.
You know, I never worry about over-fertilizing with P and K, phosphorus and potassium, because those are soil-bound. They're not going to leach into the water table at all. They're just going to be tied up there, and plants need those two nutrients. And they also do need nitrogen. And fertilizer timing can certainly influence flavor. So when people ask me how to fertilize citrus, the ideal time is at flowering, fruit set, and then not much later than June. So all of your fertilization for citrus should be done in the spring. And don't fertilize in the summer or fall, particularly in the fall, because you'll be stimulating growth that could be very susceptible to frost. And we want to avoid that.
Let me remind listeners who my guest is. Her name is Pamela Geisel Plemon, and the book is The Home Orchard, Growing Your Own Deciduous Fruit and Nut Trees. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Pamela Geisel Plemons, who has written a reference book for The Home Orchard. And I mentioned Matt grows a lot of things in his yard. And Matt, you were asking about watering plants, because that's another thing that, oh.
Yeah, you know, right. We're starting the hot season is here.
Today.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be 100 and something today, and you know, during the winter, you know, we have wet winters. I never worry about that. And I wonder how often should I be watering, and what's the best way to water? I don't know. I guess my other question is about, and to kind of continue along with the watering, is a drip system, is that a good way to water an orchard, or should I leave that more for my annuals? Or
those are really good questions. And I will say that's a pretty involved, I mean, I teach a 3-hour class on irrigation. So there's a lot of information there. But I will say just generally, drip is wonderful. It gives you a lot of flexibility. It puts water where water is needed and not where it's not needed. So it conserves water. It's a good way to irrigate. The problem is that a lot of people use drip incorrectly, because you want to replace the water that's been used that day or that week, as opposed to deep watering. I personally think individual drippers for fruit trees, for example, if you only put one emitter out, it's not going to be enough water. And so you have to calculate, and that's one thing this book is really great for, is there are irrigation scheduling techniques, and it depends a lot on your soil type. It depends on how much sand is in that soil, how much clay. It depends on the weather, all of those things. So you should be adjusting your irrigation system, first of all, at least seasonally. The other thing that's important is, for example, a large tree will use between 40 and 60 gallons of water a day during the summer. And so think about your irrigation system. How much, if you're using drip, how much water is going on that tree every time you irrigate? If you have 1 2-gallon emitter and you irrigate for 1 hour every day, you're putting on 2 gallons of water a day. Most trees, that's not enough water. So you're going to need like 5 to 6 to 7 emitters to put on 12 gallons a day or so. And so my experience is a lot of people don't irrigate enough when they have drip. And so it's important to calculate your water needs to be accurate, and using a reference. And there are a lot of online references to how much water a tree will use per day. But if you think about that, that it's a bigger quantity than what everyone seems to think. Now, the other thing is, I think individual emitters for fruit trees don't work as well because it's such a small area that you're wetting, and that's not enough root system to support all the fruit and the canopy and everything. So I like to use micro sprays that wet a larger area and give you more flexibility, and you can put on more water at one time, assuming you have good drainage, so that you only have to irrigate every 2 or 3 days as opposed to every day. The other thing I want to say quickly about drip is, and this is the disadvantage to drip, it needs a lot more maintenance than a lot of people are willing to give. You have to check your irrigation system, I would say, at least 2 or 3 times during the season to go through that drip system because they plug up, critters get in the emitters, roots grow through the emitters. I live on an acreage, so I tend to have a rodent problem, and they come in and chew the tubing. They love the plastic tubing, and then I get these huge leaks. So really, maintenance is really important.
Well, so then we have to decide, well, what tree should I plant?
What tree should you plant? My best advice for that is to, one, plant a variety you like. You know, so if you can go to the farmer's market and taste different fruit varieties. For example, my favorite fruit, my favorite peach is, this is how I remember it, Oh Henry. Oh Henry is a wonderful peach variety. It's so good. And I can't get enough of them. And they don't grow that variety commercially.
Well, I love peaches too. In fact, so much I planted a peach tree in my yard.
Good girl.
But it didn't survive, I've given up of that. I'm wondering if it's the spot in my yard.
It could be. Could be a lot of things, Nancy. It could be planted too deeply. It could be, they get borers if they get sunburned. Sunburn is a huge problem in home gardens. Again, mostly because they don't get enough water because people are trying to drip irrigate. But that's a big question, and there's a lot of things that can cause that. So could be overwatering as well. That's a pretty common problem when people are trying to grow a fruit tree near a lawn, let's say,
A lawn. That's where mine was planted, my front yard. My guest is Pamela Geisel Plemons, and her book is The Home Orchard, Growing Your Own Deciduous Fruit and Nut Trees. So we kind of talked about some of the common problems that you see. Or any other problems that come up fairly often?
Oh, my gosh, yes. I want to be fair. You know, growing fruit trees is really great because I think it's a good use of our resources. So if you water being scarce in some years especially, space, but it's a good use of that space, an edible crop that you're spending resources on. But it does require work. They require work. And there are so many problems. But I think right now the problem that people are seeing are problems with the brown rot that I mentioned earlier, but also the fact that they have too much fruit. So I'm going to talk a little bit about fruit thinning because it's not too late to go in. Those trees want to produce fruit. And this is a really good fruit year. We had good weather. We had a lot of fog, which really contributes a lot to our chilling hours. And so that was really great. So the trees are loaded. And you need to thin. And here's my best tip for thinning fruit trees. So think about the size, the ultimate size of that fruit. You would like a nice peach, right? Mm-hmm. Instead of a whole bunch of little ones, you want a few big ones. So thinning, you want to make sure that you take the fruit off when it's about 3/4 to 1 inch in diameter or so. And you want to leave a space about the size of your fist between each fruit. Okay, so you're going to be taking off lots and lots and lots of fruit. A little developing fruits. And the best time to do that, it depends on, the time of year and when the fruit ripens. But again, when you're getting to that size of about 3/4 of an inch to an inch. So if you wait too late, you're not going to get an effect from the thinning. But it's important to do that to get good-sized fruit as well as to avoid branches breaking. The second problem we're going to start seeing right now is a problem with sunburn. Because of the hot days, they're not really, really well adapted.
In fact, when you mentioned that a peach tree could get too much sun.
Oh, yes.
And maybe that's what it was, because I planted my tree where it would get plenty of sun. I think, oh, that's good for it.
So the two things that you can do to prevent that sunburn problem. One is to make sure it's getting enough water. And not water up close to the trunk, but out what we call the drip line, which is the outer edge of that.
You have illustrations of that in the book.
Yes.
Yeah.
How to plant. It just really helps. But you'll you can paint the trunks with a latex paint. It can be indoor or outdoor. It doesn't matter. But that's white. And you mix it with half water, half paint. And paint the trunks, paint everything, especially when they're young, and especially on the south and west side, because that's where you're going to get the most intense heat. Mm-hmm. And that will protect them from sunburn. And that's really important. The other thing you can do is there are these plastic tubes that you could put around the trunk. You could also wrap it with burlap, that kind of thing, to protect it from sunburn, just to give it a barrier between the temperature and the sun and the poor little developing trunks.
Well, this is on a somewhat different subject, but in my yard, I've noticed these little mounds, and I think they are moles. And because it's different, you have a picture in your book. Here's a picture of a gopher mound, mm-hmm. and here's a picture of the moles. And some years ago, I thought, okay, this gopher is after my tree, the roots.
Definitely could be.
So I thought, okay, I don't want to kill the little guy. I just want to encourage him to go somewhere else and not eat the roots of my tree. So what can we do for gophers?
Well, gophers are a real problem, but this is where you have to be proactive in the early stages of planting. And frankly, don't be afraid to trap them, because it's very difficult to prevent gophers. But your goal is to give the plant a chance, you know, to grow and put out some roots before the gophers can do too much damage. Once the trees are established, gophers are less likely. They still can be a problem if there are too many of them, but less likely to kill the tree. But initially, because there's so few roots there to support the plant, you want to protect them at that time. And that there are gopher baskets, you know, that you can...
You have a photograph of these little gopher traps.
Right. Yeah.
And this was some years ago, so what you're just saying makes sense.
Yeah.
That gopher is no longer a problem because the tree now is big enough to...
They can... and also the roots get dense enough, and the gophers just, you know... They want little baby things. They like, you know...
That's what they were doing.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
We have always, when we plant, we have to protect not... So we do get gophers, but we have to protect against squirrels. The squirrels will eat the trunk's bark. They like that sap because it's got sugar in it and nutrition. And so they just eat the bark.
Well, you see, I have a friend whose whole backyard is a garden, and she does not like squirrels. And I thought, but they are so cute.
Well, there are several types of squirrels, and there are ground squirrels.
Yeah, you have pictures of these different squirrels in the book, too.
Yes, and a little bit about management of squirrels. And the beautiful gray, fluffy tree squirrels, they'll eat your fruit, but they're not as much of a problem as ground squirrels. Ground squirrels are just very destructive. But most people in town don't have ground squirrels. They have tree squirrels.
I think you lived for quite a few years in Fresno, and there were ground squirrels there, as I recall.
Oh, yes.
And I think they're cute. Again,
they are cute.
The other day I was watching a little squirrel climb down to where I had a fig tree. I could see him out my kitchen window, and the figs were just so bitter. And I watched this little squirrel go pick one up, nibbled a little bit, put it down, found another one, nibbled a little bit. So I thought, oh, he would be in favor of something that's sweet. Mm-hmm. So I went out and thought, oh, what he is doing is he is eating at the surface where the sweetness is and then not eating the center that is not sweet. So I thought, thank you, little squirrel.
He's telling you which ones are good and which ones are not.
But moles and gophers are can be.
Yeah, that's those kinds of problems, you know, are typical of fairly where there are a lot of fruit trees. We tend to get a lot of problems with rodents.
Well, what other pests could we can you advise us?
You know, one problem that I've noticed a lot this year because of our late rains is a problem with fire blight. Fire blight is a bacterial disease that affects fruits that are in the pome family, so apples and pears. And it's a bacteria that, interestingly enough, goes through the flower during the bloom period. So right now, it's really too late to do anything to prevent it. And what this, what it looks like is that you'll, they call it fire blight because the branches and shoots all turn black. And it looks very different than just a branch dying back. It's just, you know, the branch is dead and it has this black look to it. And the tips of it will have a little shepherd's crook. And they'll start to, they'll start to ooze a black goo, not a black, a kind of an amber color goo. And that's loaded with the bacteria. So prevention is really important. You know, you have to spray a copper spray during the bloom period to get some protection. And timing is very important. So it's too late now. But what you can do now is prune out the deadwood and reduce the inoculum or the bacteria for the following year. And it's important that you haul that stuff away so you don't leave the bacteria right in your orchard, you know, or in your garden.
My guest is Pamela Geisel-Plemons, and she is co-author of a book, The Home Orchard, Growing Your Own Deciduous Fruit and Nut Trees. Now, the nut tree, we've talked about fruit trees more, but I had not realized how many different kinds of walnuts there are because typically I buy my walnuts at retail. And they all look alike.
Like English walnuts, right?
Yeah. And then I have a friend who had walnuts that were had been harvested, but there were some that were on the ground. And he asked some friends, you want to come pick up these? And they were different, and they were delicious. So can people just plant a single walnut tree?
They can, especially in this area, because we have a lot of orchards of walnut trees. They're wind-pollinated primarily. They have catkins, and so they have lots and lots of little flowers, and they're wind-pollinated. I think that people, when they plant walnuts, they should plant some of the newer varieties, like Frankat, because they are smaller. We need the smaller trees. The old-fashioned Hartley-type walnuts, which are delicious, they're huge trees, and they're on a big black walnut rootstock, and so they get huge. So most orchardists are now going to the smaller varieties and planting a little bit closer, but they taste delicious. They're really good varieties.
After a break, I'll continue my conversation with retired professor Pamela Geisel-Plemons. Her book is The Home Orchard. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, retired professor Pamela Geisel-Plemons, who has written a reference book for the small-scale grower. I'm going to ask Matt if he has a question for you now.
Sure.
Well, yeah, when you brought up black walnut stalks, and that reminded me of an issue I have in my own yard, and I know other people in the area probably have that, is black walnut or pecan or trees that release juglone, and how that might affect other trees you're planting. Because from what I've heard is that because I had pecan, I think my little section of my neighborhood here in Chico was once a pecan orchard, and there's these huge pecan trees all over my neighborhood. And yeah, they released this thing called juglone, and I know black walnut does in much higher quantities than pecan. And what kind of things can I grow and maybe cannot grow in soil that has juglone in it?
Yeah, well, that's kind of a problem because typically you can't really replant into those areas very well, at least initially. And if you are in an area that was a walnut orchard that had black walnut or even any walnut, really, you can incorporate organic matter into that soil, and it helps to degrade that very quickly or more quickly and provide irrigation so that it leaches that material out of the soil a little bit better. You can just leave it fallow for a while and then go ahead and replant. But that does create some issues if you try to replant right away. As far as growing under them, it's tough, partly because of the shade. You know, if you want to grow under an existing tree, it's such a dense shade, and the roots are very competitive for any plants that are growing underneath those trees. It isn't just the juglone. It's all the other competition factors as well. So it just depends on what it is you want to grow. You can try a lot of different things, like some of the shade-tolerant plants. I can't really say. It depends on your yard. But there aren't any really lists of plants that will grow under walnut trees that I'm aware of. I've never really seen one.
I have a lot of these in my front yard, and the only—
Existing pecans?
Yeah. Well, actually, okay. The neighbor cut down one of them. Because it's very close, and pecan trees lose large branches. but it's funny, that's where my citrus trees grow, and they seem to do well because they still get a lot of sun. So I figured that citrus trees seem to do well. I've heard things like apple and pear do very poorly. And then I've just found, you know, these aren't fruiting trees, but like salvias and kind of native plants like that seem to do fine under them.
And that's because they don't need as much water. And I think it's more of a, we've found that it's more of a competition problem than the actual juglone problem, you know, because that's only in the leaves, and the leaves primarily decompose pretty quickly. So just from the research that I've read, it has sort of been shown that it's more of a problem because of root competition and too much shade than the actual juglone problem. So more shade-tolerant plants or plants that will tolerate low water situations seem to do better.
Well, that fits exactly with what's happening in my front yard. So I can't blame the juglone maybe so much these are some huge trees with some big root systems that suck up a lot of water.
Yep.
And okay, great, thank you.
You bet.
You also touched on sun, because that's what my friend who has a whole backyard as her garden, because she was wondering how much sun, and it sounds like it totally depends on what it is she wants to grow there.
Well, yes, but I will say that at a minimum, they need 6 to 8 hours of direct sun to grow well. Because once they get in the shade, that influences leaf development, more importantly, flower development. And if they're not getting enough sun, they're not going to develop good flower production. So a lot of orchardists, you know, that's why they try to keep just the right amount of space between the rows. It's not so much partly to get equipment down, but mostly so that the plants get sun all the way around. And that's why we use the training systems that we use in fruit trees, is to maximize sun exposure.
Let me remind listeners, my guest is Pamela Geisel-Plemons, and the book she co-authored, The Home Orchard, Growing Your Own Deciduous Fruit and Nut Trees. And for people who don't have much experience or knowledge, what is the easiest, the most productive fruit tree for our area? What would you recommend for
someone? I love that question, Nancy. That's a great question, because I think a lot of us who have small yards, we don't have a lot of time, we want a fruit tree. I think that some of the easiest things to grow are dwarf trees. And dwarf trees are grown on rootstocks that typically grown on rootstocks that dwarf the sign or the upper part of the plant, the fruit-producing part of the plant. So the rootstocks slow the growth down so it keeps them smaller. There are also what are called genetic dwarf fruit trees. And those are basically the buds are much closer together. They stay quite a bit smaller. They might be on a more vigorous rootstock, but the sign wood or the fruit-producing part of it, they're slower growing. So either of those types of dwarf fruit trees are the best. And if you can grow them in a container, a large container, because the bigger the container, the better the and more root system there will be. That confines the space and it limits the amount of pruning you have to do. And also, frankly, it limits the amount of fruit you're going to get, because I'll tell you, I have so much fruit sometimes, it's
goodness,
like I
yes.
have no idea what to do with it and no time to deal with it.
Oh, gosh, I've had that experience too, which reminds me, in your book, you also have tips for how to, once you've harvested the fruit.
Yes.
I've always wondered, well, should I put it in the refrigerator? Should I put it in plastic? How do we know how best to take care of the fruit after we've harvested it?
I think that, you know, that is so critical, because you've spent the whole year trying to get this plant to produce fruit, and you put all this effort in. You fertilize, you water, you prune, you spray as needed or as required. And I don't necessarily mean pesticides. It can be other kinds of materials or organic materials, whatever it is to manage those pests, and that you go out of town, go on your Hawaii vacation, and that's right when your peaches are ripening and you lose the whole crop. So was that a waste? Yes. So it's important to, one, remember and put on your calendar when the fruit is typically going to be ripe. And usually, and we have some of these ripening tables in our book, it'll say, you know, first part of June, first 2 weeks in June. And it, in this location, so you can adjust that for your climate zone. But put it in your calendar when approximately this fruit is going to be ripe, and don't go on vacation at that time. Also, harvest at the right time. And the right time for most home gardeners, we want fruit that is tree ripe. We don't want to get that hard fruit that we get in the market, because that sort of defeats the purpose. Our purpose is we want good quality fruit that we can eat at its peak. And that might mean you don't harvest all your fruit on one day. It's more likely that you're going to harvest some fruit every day. And either eat it right then or store it properly. And it depends on the fruit how best to store it. You know, nuts are stored a little bit differently. We store our almonds and our walnuts in the freezer. You know, we harvest and then put them all in the freezer.
Because that high oil content, especially for walnuts,
they go rancid so fast.
Oh, gosh. And I just, when I'm in stores and see the nuts just out unrefrigerated, like, gosh.
Yeah. And things like peaches, you know, you want to harvest them when they're firm but ripe. And the way to know when that is to taste them. For a home gardener, taste it. See if it's, you know, got that fruit, if it's got the right, we call it sugar to acid ratio. I tend to like fruit that is more on the acid side. I don't like it overly sweet. Some people like varieties that are very sweet. And then try to find, you know, if you don't have a lot of area, try to find a fruit tree that will hold its fruit for a long time. So, for example, in my orchard, I have a variety of a pluot. I love this pluot. It's called Dapple Dandy Pluot. And it's like a hybrid between a apricot and a plum.
Yeah.
and it's delicious. And it holds on the tree really, really well. So you can harvest over almost a 4 to 6 week period. It stays on the tree that long. On the other hand, I have a Santa Rosa plum. Not super fond of that variety. It's going to come out probably this year. But it all ripens within a week and a half period. And, you know, what do you do with all those plums except give them away? And everybody's like, it's like zucchini.
Oh, gosh.
Don't let her come near my house. I don't want any more plums.
Yeah.
So, you know, knowing some of those varieties and how long they last on the tree is really helpful. Pears, for example. Pears are unique in that you don't want them to be ripe on the tree. You want them to be very firm, and you can tell they're ready to ripe because you lift up the pear and it should snap off and with a little stem, and they still should be pretty firm. And then you can refrigerate them for quite a long time and then pull them out as you need them to soften and soften up just a little bit and soften that skin on the countertop.
Now, you mentioned the stem. So if you get cherries, sometimes if they're already harvested, sometimes it'll have a stem and sometimes it won't. So which would be better?
So once you take the stem off, there's an opening there for decay to get in. So if you have an option, it's better to harvest it with the stem, but avoid damaging the little bud that the stem is attached to or the little shoot. That's called the fruit spur. And that's where your fruit for the next year will also come from. And that spur will be very fruitful for anywhere from 3 to 5 years, and then it gets replaced down the road with another spur. But, so if you can maintain the stems on the cherries, it will allow them to last longer and have less decay in storage.
My guest is Pamela Geisel-Plemons, and she is co-author of The Home Orchard, Growing Your Own Deciduous Fruit and Nut Trees. So there's so much more we could talk about. I'd love to ask you more questions. But is there anything that you think listeners would really benefit from knowing from all your years of experience, Pamela?
Oh, golly. Well, yes. Do what you love with that. Because, you know, I love growing, but I also love traveling. And I have to say, right now, I'm struggling with that because my orchard is a little overwhelming, especially this time of year. And but yet, I want to go to Hawaii. And yeah. I want to go to Europe. I want to go hike Mont Blanc. And so that's one thing, is really plan on what you want to do long term. Trees are productive anywhere from, you know, typically 15 years. So you're making a commitment for a long time, really. But, you know, plant what you love and use those resources wisely.
Thank you. I've had that same experience, too, that just when you want to go to France, your garden is your trees. Yeah. Well, I so enjoyed your book. And like I say, it's something that I think so many people would want to have on their shelf as a reference.
Yes.
It's a wonderful reference book.
Thank you.
So thank you for putting this together for us.
You bet.
My guest has been Pamela Geisel-Plemons. Her book is The Home Orchard, Growing Your Own Deciduous Fruit and Nut Trees. Thank you, Pamela.
Thank you, Nancy. It's been fun.
And next, we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
First principles. We don't believe in the mind anymore. That's passé, done away with. It's been decreed by a man in a door mule suit. Now everyone agrees that we believe in the sanity of mobs and particle accelerators. The joke's on us. Amuse yourself in a Super Mario Party jamboree. On sale now for only a few worthless dollars. The medieval age has unfortunately been eradicated. Amusements can all be had. First principles, we have no need ponder. We don't believe in the mind anymore. The joke's on us. My very own mother wouldn't give me a job, for I have no identity, and nor does she. Just sit over there, young man, and play your box. The spirit and the flesh can have a good wait. The will and the intellect can both have a good time. And now off to your dreadful bed. V.P. Bodrix.
Songs I Sing. Will anyone like the songs I sing? Will anyone feel the truth I bring? When critics frown, do I have worth? My hidden self has given birth for all to judge and appraise, while I wait, anxious and afraid, that some won't like the songs I sing. Battles rage inside my brain, flow from the heart, or recede and abstain, to risk the hurt of self-expression, or bear the ache of self-repression. Whatever the way, the pain remains the same. Dwindle, wither, and go away, never to be seen another day. Suppress my feelings, run and hide, never let anyone inside. Or delve deep in my soul for my own sake, then share the wares that I create. My choice is really very clear. Shout out loud and say, I'm here to tell my tales. So I will bring all the songs I like to sing. Drew Tack.
Town Monument. Sleep drunk, we hear sirens from bed, and at sunrise, check our phones. I stride the neighborhood avenue to find Bidwell Mansion, Victorian landmark, yesterday pink, now charred and smoldering, grieving itself, collapsed into a Dalian dream. Light seeps through majestic trees. Locals line the sidewalk. Girl Scout alumni who toured ornate, eerie rooms with a blind and brilliant docent. Old-timers holding hands. Unwitting parents whose kids cut class to smoke weed on the veranda. Amid the rubble, steps survive, once slick from generations of weddings, picnics, first kisses. Erased footprints of those who were conquered. Before Bidwell betrayed the Mexican culture, some called him Don Juan, a title of respect. While traveling on the steamboat Bell, a boiler burst, broke his skull, and stamped a coin-sized pit above his eyebrow. A man with a hole in his head who would defend but exploit indigenous people along lush Chico Creek. I step off the curb. A sedan with open windows flies down the esplanade, and a woman shouts on repeat, "Great day for Native people! They kept slaves in there!" A villa for Machupta pagans and Annie's plan to save them. How tangled are the roots of American memory, bearing fruit both rotten and ripe. In one photo, the mansion looks stately, nostalgic, a tribute to our town. In another, obscene. So much depends on where you angle the light. Danielle Alexich.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.